principled, humanistic freedom struggles. I don't care where they are. We can't get free unless everybody's free. That's not just some lefty cliche. That's a fact. The networks of power, the structures of power that oppress people in one country are connected to the structures that oppress people in this country. So for Black folk to get free, everybody needs to be free.
We have an opportunity to not just offer solidarity in words, but to commit to political action, grassroots action, local action, and international action that will give us what justice requires. And that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea.
When I said free Palestine from the river to the sea, I was making a call for justice for Palestinian people who live inside the state of Israel, for those Palestinian people who are in the West Bank, and for those who are in Gaza. There are different forms of oppression and violence and occupation happening in each of those areas. And I was saying, I don't want to just talk about one of those areas. I want to talk about all those areas. And my ultimate vision is a single democratic state, one person, one vote, secular, for everybody. No Jew should be pushed out. No Jew should be harmed. No Palestinian should be pushed out. No Palestinian should be harmed. For me, this is the vision. That means that the land should be free from the river to the sea. That was the argument. Some people said, oh, but Hamas says from the river to the sea. And if Hamas says it, then you must be supporting Hamas and you must be supporting a project of eliminating Jews from the area. Let me be very clear. At no point was I calling for harm to Jewish people, violence against Jewish people, for pushing Jewish people out of the land. None of that is what I'm calling for. None of that is what I believe in. We must fight for and protect Jewish brothers and sisters at all costs. Jews have a right to self-determination, to freedom, to justice, to safety, to protection, to dignity. They do. But so do Palestinians. I'm calling for Palestinian self-determination and freedom. I'm calling for the liberation of Palestinian people. And if Israel were occupied, I'd be calling for the same thing. If Jews were under attack in Israel the way Palestinians are, I'd be calling for that. The same way I do for Jews who are under attack all around the world, in Europe, in the United States, in the Middle East. We have to protect Jewish people, but it can't be the only conversation we have. We have to be able to talk about protecting Jewish people and protecting Palestinian people and protecting vulnerable people around the world. And if we can do that, now we got to...
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I'm always hard put to recall them all, but the release of all political prisoners, the ending of the state of emergency, the repeal of the apartheid legislation on the books in the country, the unbanning of the anti-apartheid groups in the country. Now, some of the conditions have arguably been met, some have been only partially met, and some have not been met at all. The organizations have been unbanned. The state of emergency has been lifted in part, but one could suggest that even if it were lifted all across the country, the laws that give it muscle still remain very much in place. In South Africa, it doesn't matter whether or not you have a state of emergency or not. That's just a measure of art. The law is very much there to give the police virtually the same power, the state of emergency notwithstanding.
Mr. Randall Robinson, Executive Director of Trans-Africa, the lobby group for Africa and the Caribbean. With a mandate from the Congressional Black Caucus back in 1977, Randall Robinson formed the organization with only 2 staff persons. Currently, the organization has 12 staff persons and 1/10 of the present operating budget of $700,000. TransAfrica does not have the kind of clout or the financial support of that of an American Jewish lobby that Israel has developed. But under the leadership of Randall Robinson, TransAfrica is asserting itself as an institutional expression and extension of Pan-Africanist work started by George Padmore, C.L.R. James, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, and Paul Robeson. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America, This week, Trans Africa with Randall Robinson in Black America.
There is no question that the Bush administration and President Bush himself want to lift these sanctions, and so they will attempt to interpret fulfillment of the conditions in a way that will allow them to do just that. I think several mistakes have been made. One was the invitation to Mr. de Klerk to visit the United States.
What was your reaction?
Oh, we're very much opposed to that. And that's not to suggest that I'm opposed to full diplomatic exchange and discussion. I think our Secretary of State should see Pete Bota. I think members of Congress should go there. Members of a parliament should come here. But the Oval Office is a special place that carries a different imprimatur of American support and embrace. There are many people in the world with whom we have a diplomatic exchange we don't invite to the Oval Office. Yasser Arafat hasn't been there and won't be coming. Fidel Castro hasn't been there and won't be coming. The same is true for many, many others, through Muammar Gaddafi. And I don't suppose Saddam Hussein will cross that threshold anytime in the future. The fact is that South Africa, aside from image, very much the same way Mr. Gorbachev has done in the Soviet Union, which is proving not to be authentic, aside from image, has not changed very much in South Africa. The apartheid law is still very much on the book. Blacks cannot vote. The Group Areas Act is still in place. The Separate Amenities Act, the Internal Security Act, the Land Acts, all of these pillars of the apartheid system are still very much in place. And he essentially has done two things, largely of public relations value, released Nelson Mandela, and unbanned the ANC so that there's above-ground discussion.
On Thanksgiving Eve in 1984, Randall Robinson and three others entered the South African Embassy in Washington, D.C., and politely announced they would not leave the embassy until apartheid was abolished. Their arrest helped put apartheid on America's agenda. Sanctions were implemented, South Africans suffered, and 6 years later, Nelson Mandela was released from a South African prison. Recently, Randall Robinson brought his broad-based knowledge on South African and Caribbean affairs to the University of Texas at Austin during Black History Month celebrations. Before his presentation, this reporter sat down with this gentle, persuasive person to discuss his goals and objectives as executive director of Trans Africa.
It's difficult to get Americans to understand the problems that we faced are not peculiar to African Americans. We, in large part, live in a country of people who are woefully ignorant about foreign affairs in general. And so education is a major part of our responsibility. Unless people know about issues, you can't expect them to be concerned about those issues. But we've had some conspicuous success. I mean, we have sanctions now against South Africa because of the leadership of African Americans and because of the vigorous role that African Americans played in the campaign and drive for sanctions in Washington. So I think there is a real interest. There's still some issues we need to know a lot more about. Issues of U.S. Economic assistance to African countries, refugee policy, trade policy, all of those less than exciting economic issues that are tremendously important to countries attempting to develop their economies, but issues about which Americans in the main know very, very little. And it's not just a problem on the African issues, it's global. And in large part, that's why we've launched headlong into a war that I think we will live to regret in the Gulf now, because most Americans don't understand anything about the Arab world or the consequences that we will have to face before this war is over and long after it's concluded.
Has the mood Americans have towards Africa changed since the formation of Trans Africa in 1977?
Well, I think we've come a long way from Tarzan.
Okay.
But we have still a very long, long way to go. I think Americans are less indelibly prejudiced in their images of Africa than they were, but I still think they are woefully badly informed, inasmuch as very few Americans know what the countries are of Africa. They think of the Caribbean as a beach and don't know very much about the rest of the world. Few Americans can name a province in Canada or a state in Mexico, for that matter. So it's not just a problem of our perceptions of Africa, but it's a kind of an American parochialism that's general, that is a problem in this country for black and white, rich and poor, east, west, north, south. It's a major American problem, and it's a large cause of foolish foreign policy in the last analysis.
How has the financial support for Trans-Africa evolved over the years?
Well, we grew from an organization that started with a grant of $5,000 from the Africa Office of the National Council of Churches 13 years ago to an organization with a $700,000 a year budget and over $1 million in a small endowment with a national capital campaign now to buy our own home, a process that will be completed within the next year. So we've come a long way, and a large part of that support has come from the black community in the United States.
How has the staff grown?
Well, we started with me and a secretary. Now we have about 17 people and 12 chapters across the country, and interns and volunteers.
Getting back to the answer to the question before this, when you spoke of information, is it American media here? Have they lost an interest in Africa, or is it incumbent upon African Americans to seek out that information to better inform about the continent of Africa and our foreign policy towards that country?
Well, American media certainly hasn't lost an interest in Africa. It never had any, and it doesn't have any interest in any part of the world save Europe. The Soviet Union, Israel, perhaps, but Latin America, Asia, Africa, the Caribbean are not hot topics in American media. And when you exclude perhaps the Washington Post and the New York Times, the coverage from the rest of print media in this country is absolutely deplorable. Papers in Texas conspicuous for deplorable coverage. When there's any coverage at all, it's bad. And that's not just a problem for Africa. It's a problem even in the current crisis in the Middle East, a crisis in which Arabs are depicted for the American population as something just the other side of savage. And so there are other people in the world who have suffered from this this sort of racist depiction. Black Americans have to learn, though, rather than to simply carp incessantly about racism, that nobody will take care of our interest for us. We need more blacks in the decision-making process in media across this country, at ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, the major papers, the wires. In every room where there's a decision made that's vital to our interest, we have to be represented. No one will take care of those interests for us. And so we need young blacks to understand that we have to be adequately represented wherever decisions are made in this country that affect our interest. But to do that, we have to train our young people in college to understand power and where our interests lie. And that's not always the case. Too many young people want to be in front of a camera as opposed to behind it. The important editorial decisions are not made by those who accomplish celebrity status in front of cameras, but by those who set media policy. Who decides what story is going to be written and how it's going to be written, how it's going to be edited? Who are the assignment editors at all of these papers? And that's how important decisions are made, whether the story will be on the front page, on the back pages, whether it will be in the paper at all, whether it will be above the fold or beneath the fold, how many column inches it will get, whether it's going to make the news, the evening news or not. All of these things are determinations made by people. And if we're not in the room, you can't expect a favorable determination.
Your opinion of the black press in covering Africa and foreign policy towards that country?
Well, I think it certainly has been better than the white press. I am particularly impressed with a new magazine, Emerge, that's perhaps the most important magazine produced in black America in a very, very long time. There's serious discussion and analysis, thoughtful debate. I know the people who are running Emerge, and of course they expect and anticipate to lose money for a few years. I only hope their pockets are deep enough to make this a viable undertaking. In the main, the rest of the black press is pretty frivolous business, with the exception of, to some large degree, I think, of course, of Black Enterprise. It takes up serious issues, to some degree, Essence magazine. But, and this is not to condemn the other publications at all, simply to say that plus media products reflect the community that is to consume those products. And people who run magazines and television shows are in business, and business must have a market, and it's really a question of the demand of the community that must consume the product. We must demand. You see, Johnson Publications started with a very serious publication, Negro Digest, that became Black World, and it failed, while Jet and Ebony thrived. There's a reason for that. The reason's not to be found at Johnson Publication headquarters, but it's to be found in the appetites of the black community. That's where the problem is.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message.
We're tracing the decisions that gave us the housing situation we have in Austin today. In Growth Machine, how Austin engineered its housing market. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to this episode of In Black America.
Why did you feel it was important in 1984, Thanksgiving Eve, to enter the South African Embassy in Washington, D.C.?
Well, President Reagan had vetoed a moderate resolution of condemnation at the offered in the Security Council at the United Nations, condemning South Africa for arresting the entirety of the labor union leadership in that country that September. And it was just intolerable. It was a case in which P.W. Botha had virtually become indistinguishable from President Reagan in attitudes about apartheid. And so we went to indicate our own consternation with American policy and South African policy, not having, of course, the faintest notion that 5,000 Americans would follow us at the embassy to be arrested, and that movement would galvanize American momentum to pass the sanctions that since 1986 have cost South Africa over $10 billion in lost income. So it's made a real difference. But there comes a time when people have to make a decision to do whatever is necessary to dramatize our feelings about issues like this. And Mary Frances Berry and Walter Fauntleroy and I at the time felt very strongly about it, and we had no reservations, and I think we've been vindicated. There are six conditions under the sanctions law, five that are in one part of the law, and the sixth condition, four of the first five must be met for one or more of the sanctions to be lifted, but for all of them to be repealed, the sixth condition must be satisfied, and that condition is that apartheid has to have been substantially dismantled before all of the sanctions can be lifted. The other conditions, I'm always hard put to recall them all, but the release of all political prisoners, the ending of the state of emergency, the repeal of the apartheid legislation on the books in the country, the unbanning of the anti-apartheid groups in the country. Now, some of the conditions have arguably been met. Some have been only partially met, and some have not been met at all. The organizations have been unbanned. State of emergency has been lifted in part, but one could suggest that even if it were lifted all across the country, the laws that give it muscle still remain very much in place. In South Africa, it doesn't matter whether or not you have a state of emergency or not. That's just a measure of art. The law is very much there to give the police virtually the same power, the state of emergency notwithstanding. Then there's the question of the release of political prisoners. There's still many behind bars, and of course there's the argument about who is a political prisoner and who is not, and so that's the question. Then the issue of the unbanning of political parties, while the government says that has been done, you still don't have free passage in and out of the country of people who belong to those parties. And so that raised questions about whether the unbanning is indeed authentic. We met last year with Secretary Baker to discuss this, and had major, or at least some suggestion that we will have some difference of opinion over the last condition, that apartheid has to have been substantially dismantled. Of course, the other conditions are, in the main, objective conditions. This one, of course, is very subjective. And he indicated to us that that could be a matter over which we might disagree. There is no question that the Bush administration and President Bush himself want to lift these sanctions, and so they will attempt to interpret fulfillment of the conditions in a way that will allow them to do just that. The apartheid law is still very much on the book. Blacks cannot vote. The Group Areas Act is still in place. The Separate Amenities Act, the Internal Security Act, the Land Acts, all of these pillars of the apartheid system are still very much in place. And he essentially has done two things, largely of public relations value: released Nelson Mandela and unbanned the ANC so that there's above-ground discussion, which has given him an image of a reformer that, in large part, is undeserved. That's not to suggest that he has been acting in good faith, in bad faith. That the point is that much of what he's promised to deliver remains undelivered. And until we see that delivery, I think it's premature of the president to invite him into the Oval Office, because he has restored him to the community of acceptable nations in so doing. And so I think we see a good deal of hypocrisy in American policy in this regard. We're prepared to lickety-split invade Iraq. We gave sanctions no real opportunity to work there when the very president, who was such alacrity, wanted to move ahead in Iraq, opposed sanctions against South Africa and continues to do so. So I think we've got a very hypocritical president and a very hypocritical policy process in this regard, particularly with respect to Iraq, since the very weapons our young men will be facing were supplied in large part by the United States, supported by the very president who now wants Mr. Saddam Hussein's head on a platter. But that's not new, isn't it? Noriega worked for us at one time, too, directly for President Bush. So it's important to remember that our policy seldom is rooted in any general morality that I can understand.
Trans Africa has initiated two programs, college programs, one at Lincoln University and the other at Spelman College. How did the initiation of those programs come about?
Well, they more than Lincoln and Spelman. As a matter of fact, they involve about 18 historically black colleges. But much of the leadership has come from Jeanetta Cole of Spelman, president of Spelman, and
the Aristodocacy, the president of Lincoln University. Norman Francis down at Xavier in New Orleans has been very vigorous in this regard, too. The idea is to find young black men and women who want to pursue careers in foreign affairs. Even those who don't know they want to pursue careers in foreign affairs, to interest them, to make them aware that such careers are available to them, and to prepare them to take the Foreign Service exam, to get up the pass rate of blacks who take that exam. Again, as I was talking about in the press, if you expect to influence policy in media, in business, in foreign policy, anywhere you are in any sphere, you have to be in the room and you have to be well represented. And if we're going to do that in foreign policy, we're going to need more ambassadors, we're going to need more foreign service officers, we're going to need more people at the Agency for International Development, more people in the Congress, more people at the Commerce Department, at Treasury, the World Bank, the IMF, all of these places. We need to have people representing as well, and we need to make our young people aware of these career opportunities. The only American government agency in the area of foreign policy that vigorously recruits on black campuses and on predominantly white campuses, vigorously recruits blacks, is the CIA, and that's indeed tragic. But what we've got to know, again, back to my notion that there's no point just copying about racism. For people who have power and abuse it, they don't cherish the notion of sharing it with anybody, so nobody's going to come looking for us saying that we've been hogging the decision-making process and we think this is wrong and my come and share it with us fairly. That's not how the game is played. We've got to discover how the world is run, and to demand our rightful place at the decision-making table, and that's a table with many chairs and many tables and many rooms, and we've got to be in all of them. And this program is to acquaint kids in college with this as a career opportunity and prepare them to take and pass this exam. It's a very difficult exam. And historically, we've had a very poor pass rate, but the others who take the exam have exam preparation courses. We've got to give our kids the same edge, and that's what we're doing with the historically black colleges now.
This program will also be on the elementary school level also?
In the long term, certainly at the high school level, because so much of the of whatever success you're going to have in taking this exam turns on your grasp of general information. It's not the kind of exam that you can prepare for well in a cram course. You might be asked where the Pyrenees are. You might be asked where's Peru, or where's the Amazon, what's the largest river in the world, where is Xhosa spoken. You might be asked a range of things, the Ural Mountains, the Ba'ath political party, and all of these sorts of general information questions that you'd be best able to answer were you to start reading early on in the process. And so our young people really need to read Time and Newsweek and Emerge and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, read op-ed pieces, read foreign newspapers, read and read and read and read. And when you get towards your senior year in college and beyond, ready to take an exam like the Foreign Service exam, you'll find that all pays off. The black male in this country is in frightful danger. When you look at the figures of what's happening in our cities, and you've added to it crack cocaine, that not just jeopardizes the black male anymore, but the black woman. And children born into a world of crack, bonding not possible between mother and child, all of these things are happening in the black community, a community where production of children is greater from the bottom than it is from the top. And so some sort of intervention is vitally necessary. And it starts with, I think, a good view of yourself. I mean, you can't have a worldview unless you have world information. And you can't be an activist on that level unless you have a positive view of yourself and your place in the general scheme of things. And I don't think we have that like we should. I think perhaps we're better than we used to be, but I still think we have an awful long way to go.
The late Randall Robinson, attorney, author, and founder of Trans Africa. Robinson died on March 24, 2023. He was 81. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez and Cliff Hargrove, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs.
And welcome to a special Labor Day edition of Book Bundle. I wanted to talk about a writer that I've been obsessed with for some time now, and that I had the honor of seeing one of his plays on Broadway. We guess I'm talking about Mabulu. Now, if you've never heard of Mabulu, that's because you haven't read the new book, August Wilson, A Life, by Patty Hartigan. Hartigan points out that he once had an African name when he went through his Black nationalist period. And I was shocked to find that out. But there's so many similarities that August Wilson has to so many other writers. And I want to get to that in a moment. So I want to talk a little bit about Hartigan's book, and then I want to read an extended excerpt from her book. So let's first talk about the author and the subject. The author is a former Boston Globe writer who's written extensively about plays and the theater. And she wrote this biography of August Wilson based on partly her extensive experience covering August Wilson. So there's so many things I learned. So for instance, August Wilson, all of these stories that come out of him, right? All these monologues that come out of him, right? Do they come out of the ether? No, not exactly. They're out of the stories of his family, along with ones that he's heard in, you know, the many bars and restaurants and diners that he wrote for decades. August found the blues as his soundtrack and score. He actually bought a collection of 5-cent 78 records, singles. Let's see. 78 records are not singles, are they? No, 78 are those old records. That's right. Forgive me, audience. Those old records, 78s. And like Baldwin, he was inspired by Bessie Smith's voice. There are historic names, of course, listed in this book, Larry Neal and Mary Baraka. I kept thinking about the similarities between August Wilson and Baraka. Both dropped out of school. Baraka dropped out of Howard. August Wilson dropped out of high school. They both did a stint in the service. They both attempted to write poetry. Of course, Baraka was more successful than August Wilson, but August Wilson had to find a space for his kind of poetry. August Wilson was inspired by Baraka, by the way, because they both straddled different worlds. Another similarity between him and many, many, many writers. He was not Frederick August Kittle for his whole life. He decided to take out a typewriter and type out his new name. He created his name out of his family background. I mean, I found that quite fascinating. Like Baldwin, he stays away from the city he's writing about. He lives a lot of his life in Seattle and St. Paul, Minnesota. But artistically, he's attached to Pittsburgh the way Baldwin is attached to Harlem. Like Baldwin, he learned from the library. He spent 5 years in the library, Wilson did, after a black teacher challenged him on a paper and he dropped out of school. Wilson formed the Central Avenue Poets, went from poems to prose. There are mentions, of course, of him starting at the Black Horizons Theater and the Penumbra Theater in St. Paul. The Black Horizons Theater was a theater in Pittsburgh. Of course, his situation is filled with contradictions. He needed to be a black nationalist. He called for the development of black theater, but he never premiered his plays in black communities. Again, we mentioned the bars and the diners, but then we go from that to Eugene O'Neill, the Eugene O'Neill Center for Playwrights, and of course, its operator, Lloyd Richards, the very famous director of A Raisin in the Sun, and later the Yale Repertory Theater. And we see the various power struggles between the playwright and the director, which was Lloyd Richards, but later it would be Wilson, because Richards and Wilson would have a father-son spat, and Wilson would go on his own. And finally, the other part of the power struggle was with the producers. You know, Fences? I was really surprised to find out that Fences is basically the August Wilson equivalent of a pop single. He wrote it because he wanted people to believe that he could write a play with a regular structure and a hero and all of that. And so I'm just surprised. Like, it's his least favorite play. So, thinking again and again about this amazing personality, this amazing man, and how he created himself out of himself, I keep thinking about, you know, is his story outdated in 2023? My answer is hell yes and hell no. Today, we seem to be dealing with race and class and the arts by embracing them. So in 2023, elite college students of.
This is a commentary on the Black World Media Network.
Hey, this is Bill Fletcher, former president of Trans Africa Forum, longtime trade unionist and writer, coming back to you today, which in the United States is Labor Day. And, you know, this is one of those interesting things that most of the world celebrates May 1st as Labor Day, International Workers' Day. The United States, for a whole host of reasons, not the least being a desire by the ruling elites to separate U.S. workers from the rest of the planet, came up with a September Labor Day. All right, such as it is. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about this particular moment here in the States is the increased interest in unions and the increasing levels of union organizing and militancy that we see around the country. And this is exciting. Public opinion and public support for unions hasn't been this high in years. Growing sympathy that has been spreading, you see whether it's the Starbucks workers, you see the militancy of the UPS workers, see the organizing of minor league baseball players, the United Auto Workers are gearing up for a potential strike. Number of things going on out there around the country. And obviously to that you must add Amazon, Amazon workers that have been organizing. Yet, what is missing is an overall strategy. A strategy for union renewal. So it's exciting to watch these organizing efforts, and I don't want to take anything away from them. But what we don't have a sense of is anything that comes close to what we saw in the 1930s and early 40s, where entire industries were being organized. There was a coherent strategy that was underway. And on top of that, there was a connection between that organizing and other work, pro-democracy work that was taking place in the country, particularly anti-fascist work. And this issue of anti-fascist work has a special importance now with the growth of the so-called MAGA movement, the Make America Great Again movement, initiated by Trump, but has a long legacy. You know, you could look at the Tea Party and other right-wing forces. And it's in this situation that it's all quiet on the union front. You have very few union leaders, and there's a few notable exceptions, but very few union leaders that are speaking up against the rise of right-wing authoritarianism. Many of them seem to be completely petrified at speaking up and would rather believe that workers can be united simply through hard-fought economic battles. It won't work that way. There is some real trade union militants who are also quite right-wing. And unless the leadership of organized labor is very explicit in its anti-right-wing authoritarianism and its anti-fascism, it leaves room for ambiguity in terms of what does the trade union movement stand for. So on the one hand, we need a very coherent organizing strategy that is particularly focused on the South and the Southwest, major areas of low union density. And this needs to take place in conjunction with social movements there on the ground. So that's one thing. And the other thing is a clear and unapologetic stand by the leadership, the leaders of organized labor, against the rising tide of right-wing authoritarianism. These two things must go together, or we're toast. This is Bill Fletcher signing off.
Keep listening to the Black World Media Network and hear outstanding commentaries from some of the finer minds of the diaspora.
On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs.
And welcome to a special Labor Day edition of Book Bundle. I wanted to talk about a writer that I've been obsessed with for some time now, and that I had the honor of seeing one of his plays on Broadway. We guess I'm talking about Mabulu. Now, if you've never heard of Mabulu, that's because you haven't read the new book, August Wilson, A Life, by Patty Hartigan. Hartigan points out that he once had an African name when he went through his Black nationalist period. And I was shocked to find that out. But there's so many similarities that August Wilson has to so many other writers. And I want to get to that in a moment. So I want to talk a little bit about Hartigan's book, and then I want to read an extended excerpt from her book. So let's first talk about the author and the subject. The author is a former Boston Globe writer who's written extensively about plays and the theater, and she wrote this biography of August Wilson based on partly her extensive experience covering August Wilson. So there's so many things I learned. So for instance, August Wilson, all of these stories that come out of him, right? All these monologues that come out of him, right? Do they come out of the ether? No, not exactly. They're out of the stories of his family, along with ones that he's heard in, you know, the many bars and restaurants and diners that he wrote for decades. August found the blues as his soundtrack and score. He actually bought a collection of 5-cent 78 records, singles. Let's see. 78 records are not singles, are they? No, 78 are those old records. That's right. Forgive me, audience. Those old records, 78s. And like Baldwin, he was inspired by Bessie Smith's voice. There are historic names, of course, listed in this book, Larry Neal and Mary Baraka. I kept thinking about the similarities between August Wilson and Baraka. Both dropped out of school. Baraka dropped out of Howard. August Wilson dropped out of high school. They both did a stint in the service. They both attempted to write poetry. Of course, Baraka was more successful than August Wilson, but August Wilson had to find a space for his kind of poetry. August Wilson was inspired by Baraka, by the way, because they both straddled different worlds. Another similarity between him and many, many, many writers. He was not Frederick August Kittle for his whole life. he decided to take out a typewriter and type out his new name. He created his name out of his family background. I mean, I found that quite fascinating. Like Baldwin, he stays away from the city he's writing about. He lives a lot of his life in Seattle and St. Paul, Minnesota. But artistically, he is attached to Pittsburgh the way Baldwin is attached to Harlem. Like Baldwin, he learned from the library. He spent 5 years in the library, Wilson did, after a black teacher challenged him on a paper and he dropped out of school. Wilson formed the Central Avenue Poets, went from poems to prose. There are mentions, of course, of him starting at the Black Horizons Theater and the Penumbra Theater in St. Paul. The Black Horizons Theater was a theater in Pittsburgh. Of course, his situation is filled with contradictions. He needed to be a black nationalist. He called for the development of black theater, but he never premiered his plays in black communities. Again, we mentioned the bars and the diners, but then we go from that to Eugene O'Neill, the Eugene O'Neill Center for Playwrights, and of course, its operator, Lloyd Richards, the very famous director of A Raisin in the Sun, and later the Yale Repertory Theater. And we see the various power struggles between the playwright and the director, which was Lloyd Richards. But later it would be Wilson, because Richards and Wilson would have a father-son spat, and Wilson would go on his own. And finally, the other part of the power struggle was with the producers. You know, Fences? I was really surprised to find out that Fences is basically the August Wilson equivalent of a pop single. He wrote it because he wanted people to believe that he could write a play with a regular structure and a hero and all of that. And so I'm just surprised, like it's his least favorite play. So thinking again and again about this amazing personality, this amazing man, and how he created himself out of himself, I keep thinking about, you know, is his story outdated in 2023? My answer is hell yes and hell no. Today, we seem to be dealing with race and class and the arts by embracing them. So in 2023, elite college students of all races become MFA professors. MFAs are the Masters in Fine Arts. Those are the equivalents of the doctorate in arts. And they write and pay bills all along the way. This kind of romantic poverty that August Wilson lived in. I remember hearing stories about how he would get evicted every 3-4 months and have to drag his record collection with him every 3-4 months when he moved into another place. I mean, all of that is kind of passé, correct? Well, I would say so if it wasn't for this Writers Guild strike, because it looks like the starving artist cliche is passé, but if you read articles about this WGA strike, I mean, food pantries in California, and then you have these openly hurting playwrights who wrote for TV and film in order to not suffer for their art. Both the pantries and the playwrights are feeling serious pinches as Hartigan releases his book. Playwriting then seems to be a loving, lyrical curse, inflicting pain to focus the mind. Freedom is indeed never free, and labor is ever subjected to exploitation. Like his characters, August struggled from constraints. His talent will be rarely equaled, but his determination for pure art, what he called, quote, the blood's memory, end quote, needs to be bottled and sold. So now I want to read an excerpt, an extended excerpt from August Wilson, A Life by Patty Hartigan. I want to read the prologue. The book begins with an epigraph by August Wilson. To arrive at this moment in my life, I've traveled many roads, some circuitous, some brambled and rough, some sharp and straight, and all of them have led, as if by some grand design, to one burnished with art and small, irrevocable tragedies. Again, that's the epigraph from August Wilson. On March 22nd, 2003, under a somber gray sky, August Wilson walked slowly up the steps of St. Benedict the Moor Church, the grand, imposing Roman Catholic cathedral on Crawford Street at the base of Pittsburgh's Hill District. The temperature was in the low 50s, typical for early spring in Pittsburgh, but an unforgiving drizzle added a nip to the air. Wilson had cut short a trip to Syracuse to be back in Pittsburgh that day. He sported a black turtleneck and a brown tweed jacket, topped by a trench coat to keep away the chill. His signature Borlasano fedora shadowed the deep circles under his puffy eyes. His neatly trimmed beard was more salt than pepper. He hadn't originally planned on spending the day back home in Pittsburgh. His latest play, Gem of the Ocean, was about to make its world premiere in less than a month at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. He had finished a very rough draft, and he would rewrite during rehearsals the same way he had revised the other plays in his ambitious 10-play cycle about African Americans in the 20th century. Jim was the 9th play in the cycle. He had one more to go, and he already felt the pressure of completing the goal he had set for himself so long ago. He had also foolishly agreed to write and perform a one-man autobiographical show for a benefit fundraiser at the Seattle Repertory Theater. He hadn't written a word, and he had just 2 months left before he had to get up on stage and play himself as a young man. He was a perennial procrastinator, but standing on the steps of that church, looking up toward the Hill District, he was burdened by grief and memories, many of them painful. He had mourned his mother, Daisy Wilson, at this very church 20 years ago, almost to the day. He knew he was going to pay tribute to her in his one-man show, and he had already thought about what to say. "There will come a day when you will suffer the most profound grief imaginable," is what he eventually wrote. "And you look up and find out all them years you'd been living in your mother's prayers, and now you've got to live on your own." This church, so noble and grand, evoked images from the past. As a boy, Wilson had attended the parochial school at Holy Trinity in the Lower Hill District, but the school was demolished during an ill-informed period of urban renewal in the late 1950s. Several parishes merged to form St. Benedict the Moor, named for an Italian Franciscan friar who was born of African slaves and celebrated for his charity. The church commissioned a giant statue of its patron saint in 1968, the same year as the assassination of Martin Luther King. The 18-foot-tall landmark faces with its arms stretched in welcome to the people of downtown Pittsburgh, its back turned on the Hill District. The orientation of the statue of a saint with African blood turning its back on his people had infuriated Wilson the day it was unveiled. It still did. But he was here to bury one of his friends, not to resurrect old grievances. Wilson never missed a funeral. His life and his work reinforced the notion that attention must be paid to history, to ancestral roots, to family, and to friends, both celebrated and obscure. He stopped briefly outside the church to greet Nate Smith, the legendary labor leader who had famously laid down in front of a moving bulldozer in 1969 to protest the absence of black union workers at the Three Rivers Stadium construction site. Smith's bald head glistened, his mournful eyes rimmed red. Wilson had been an impressionable young man in his early 20s when Smith led thousands in protest marches in downtown Pittsburgh, ultimately forcing the mayor and the union leaders to develop a plan to admit blacks and women into the city's entrenched trade unions. Smith was one of his heroes back then, but today the two men met as peers, fellow mourners. While Smith was organizing protests, Wilson was living in a shady basement apartment on Crawford Street, just a block over from St. Benedict's. He was an aspiring young poet, a high school dropout who loved words as much as he loved the sweet smell of a woman's perfume in the late night hours. He wrote poetry on a manual Royal Standard typewriter. That typewriter had been replaced long ago, and the apartment building had been demolished. But he had forged deep friendships with his fellow poets back then. He had found his vocation right there on those streets by becoming one of a quartet known as the Center Avenue Poets. Charlie Williams, Nicholas Flournoy, Rob Penny, and Wilson. Swept up in the Black Nationalist Movement, they aimed to change the world with poetry and plays by giving the people a voice. And that is what brought Wilson, now an acclaimed playwright, winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes, a Tony Award, and numerous honorary degrees, to the steps of this church, not far from where he had grown up, the son of a single mother in a 2-room flat with no indoor plumbing. He was back home to bury Rob Penny. a small, wiry man with an infectious grin. Penny had preceded Wilson at Central Catholic High School, the elite exam school in Oakland, a neighborhood that's a stone's throw from Carnegie Mellon University and miles away in mindset from the Hill District. Despite rampant racism at the school, Penny had been able to succeed because he was the fastest runner on the track team, and whip smart, too. Wilson was accepted 2 years after Penny's graduation. He withdrew after barely a year, tired of the racist notes that were left on his desk and the jokes played at his expense. Penny graduated and was a celebrated star athlete. Years later, Wilson saw him take a dare from a group of teenagers hanging out in the park. The upstarts thought they could beat the old man with the graying dreadlocks in a 100-yard dash. Penny won. He always won. The two former Central Catholic students had been brothers back when they were aspiring young artists. They had bonds. They had a past together. Back in the 1960s, Penny called himself Brother Oba, which means king in the Yoruba and Bini languages of West Africa. Wilson took the name Babulu, the name of a town in Tanzania. Together in 1968, the two men launched Black Horizons Theater, creating art from the ashes of the fiery demonstrations at Rock Pittsburgh after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. They were poets and dreamers who subscribed to the principles of Amiri Baraka's Black Arts Movement, which espoused that theater and art could empower the Black community. Penny was able to turn his poetry acumen and community activism into a teaching slot at the University of Pittsburgh's newly formed Department of Africana Studies in 1969. There was no place for Wilson in the department, but he didn't begrudge his friend his good fortune. Penny, at least, had graduated from high school. Wilson continued to struggle as a penniless poet and playwright for many years while Penny enjoyed the perks and acclaim of the Academy. Penny went on to become chairman of Africana Studies in 1978, serving until 1984 and remaining an esteemed professor until his death of a heart attack on March 16, 2003. Wilson, on the other hand, worked every odd job from dishwasher to short order cook. His first nibble at theatrical success came in 1982 when his play Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was accepted to be developed at the prestigious Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut. He included his Pittsburgh friends in that small amount of triumph. Penny and another Pitt professor, Curtis Porter, traveled to Waterford to see the play. Wilson continued to invite his Pittsburgh brothers to his Broadway openings, and he also celebrated their achievements over the years. Back in the day, Penny had taken to wearing dashikis, while Wilson wore musty tweed sports coats he brought at the St. Vincent de Paul thrift shop. A coat went for 35 cents, and a tie cost a nickel. Now his tweed had a better pedigree, but Wilson still related to the young man who shopped the bargain stores. Before Wilson set foot in the church, Penny's family sent a message to him. All the mourners were invited to say a few words about the departed, except August Wilson. Wilson believed in speaking well of the dead. He spoke at funerals of folks he barely knew, impoverished street characters he gave a few bucks to when they were down in their luck. Not speak at Rob's funeral? He told his younger brother, Richard Cattell, that he was crushed. Many of his contemporaries saw him during the services and noticed that his legs buckled ever so slightly. His lips sank downward, making his mustache seem like a deep frown. Sally Goodine, an actor from the old days who had gone on to a career in local politics and activism, saw the normally self-restrained Wilson weep openly over the coffin. Mark Clayton Southers, an aspiring playwright, noted that Wilson was inconsolable. He didn't know that his idol, August Wilson, had been silenced because of his own success. Wilson was aware that the people who had been his dearest friends in the old days resented his acclaim. Some of them had suggested to one another privately that he had somehow sold out because of his commercial success on Broadway. When he gave his controversial speech, "The Ground on Which I Stand," in 1996, he was shattered that many of his friends from the theater failed to support him publicly. The fiery speech called for the creation of more Black theaters and denounced colorblind casting as demeaning to Blacks. Many of the Wilson warriors, the actors who made their livings performing in his plays, were silent. That stung more. Wilson had noticed over the years that the more successful he became, the more distant his former brothers grew. Poet Nick Flournoy, however, had remained true to their friendship, even as he continued to work primarily as a community activist. But Wilson knew others questioned his loyalties. He knew they envied his success. But he also knew that he was still the guy who wrote in basements and restaurants, even if he could afford the penthouse suite. His reception at the funeral accentuated the conflicting emotions about the city he celebrated in his plays. "I have this love-hate relationship with Pittsburgh," he once said. "This is my home, and at times I miss it and find it tremendously exciting, and other times I want to catch the first thing out that has wheels." When he exited the church with his fellow mourners, he had trouble containing the deep lump in his throat and the steady flow from his watery eyes. A crowd had gathered at Freedom Corner, directly across the street from the church. Wilson was just a boy in the 1950s when developers encroached on the lower part of the Hill District, threatening to destroy the bustling, multi-ethnic enclave where he grew up. The developers raised the lower hill to put up the civic arena, displacing thousands of people and creating a wasteland of urban blight. In the 1960s, protesters put up signs saying, "No redevelopment beyond this point," drawing a line at the corner of Center Avenue and Crawford Street. The spot became known as Freedom Corner, a place where protesters gathered to begin marches for social justice and racial equality. Nate Smith had launched many of his protests there. His name was inscribed along with those of other civil rights leaders in the monument that was finally built on the spot in 2001. Wilson's younger cousin, Renee Wilson, his Uncle Frank's daughter, whom he barely knew, but who had grown up to be a crackerjack community activist, had called him sometime earlier. She had organized a group called People Against Police Violence to protest the deaths of 5 black men killed by Pittsburgh police. She had scheduled a demonstration for March 22nd. The victims' stories sounded like anecdotes from a Wilson play. One of the dead was a 12-year-old boy who was shot in the back while fleeing from police after a car robbery. Renee Wilson was dedicated to the cause of No Justice, No Peace, and she asked her famous cousin to attend the protest. He declined her request. He had planned to be in Chicago on that day working on his play. Renee had also called Rob Penny. She had taken a writing class with him at Pitt, and he had encouraged her to keep writing poetry. She asked that he speak at the rally. He agreed to attend, but he would not speak. As it turned out, Penny was there, but in a coffin. Renee had planned on starting the march downtown earlier in the day, but out of respect for Penny, she postponed the beginning of the demonstration until after the funeral. Wilson must have been aware of the symbolism of the moment. Like his cousin, he had harbored dreams of changing the world, but he had had to leave Pittsburgh to do it. He had walked those same streets when he was a young man, but even though he had almost accomplished what he set out to do when he started writing his cycle of 10 plays, some of his former friends had branded him as the one who had turned his back on the community, just like that statue of St. Benedict the Moor. The hearse went one way, and the protesters another. Wilson had written plays that dramatized the reasons for the protest his cousin was leading. He had done his part. He had found his song and shared it with audiences all over the world, but he hadn't expected to pay such a high personal price. He looked across the street at the protesters and looked at the hearse. He followed the funeral procession. It was time for another generation to take over the struggle. So that's the prologue of August Wilson Alive, written with great vest, as you see, by Patty Hartigan. I think it's the first major biography of August Wilson. I hope it won't be the last, but if it is the last, this is a very good biography to go out on. I would also recommend the August Wilson PBS documentary that you can find on Amazon Prime and other places that stream PBS documentaries. Thank you for spending part of your Labor Day with me. For the Black World Media Network, I'm Todd Stephen Burroughs.
That was Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats, presented by reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs, journalist, historian, and popular culture enthusiast. We'll be right back.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
From around 1874, 75 till 1908, it was just a convict lease system there. So most of the field were worked by convict labor. Mm-hmm. And then in 1908, a couple of the huge plantations went into receivership, which I guess means they were so in debt they had to change ownership.
Yes. Right, exactly.
And that's when the Imperial Sugar Company took over, and they sold one of the huge plantations to the state of Texas, the plantation where these 95 bodies were eventually found. They sold it to the state of Texas to run a state-run prison farm. So it was the same as convict leasing, but now the state was completely in control of it. And when they sold it, the contract said, okay, this is your land, but any sugar cane you harvest, you have to sell it to the Imperial Sugar Company. Mm. And that's how Imperial kept profiting from convict labor, even after the convict lease system ended around 1910, 1912.
Brittany Martin, co-host and executive producer of Sugarland. Sugarland is an 8-episode podcast that explores how the discovery of a cemetery forced the city to confront its history and the 95 African-American individuals unearthed during the construction in Sugarland, Texas, 30 miles southwest of Houston. In 2018, a construction team was building a new school in Sugarland. There, workers discovered something shocking, an unmarked cemetery containing 95 bodies. The individuals buried there are believed to be part of a convict leasing program that began in the late 1800s. Ranging in age from 14 to 70, the inmates had muscular builds, but were malnourished, their bones misshapen from back-breaking repetitive labor. They were buried in plain pine boxes between 1878 and 1911. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Sugarland, the podcast with co-host and executive producer Brittany Martin, In Black America.
We've been through so many different versions of this story. Mm-hmm. I think for Naomi and I, we really had to learn the history before we could go further into what happened over the past 5 years. So that involved going to the Texas State Archives, archives in all kinds of parts of the state, state archives everywhere, North Texas and Houston and Austin, and just digging through these handwritten cursive reports, trying to make sense of this history and get it all straight in our heads. And then we could sort of tell the story that was unfolding in Sugarland. By sort of going back, we started working on it in 2021, early 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And the cemetery was found in 2018. So we had a bit of hindsight, which benefited us a lot when we were trying to tell a more complete story of the Sugarland 95.
The 95 African Americans have become known collectively as the Sugarland 95, and in November 2019, they were laid to rest at the site where their remains were originally found. The gravesite dates back to the years after the Civil War, when hundreds of African American men were sent to convict labor camps in the area to harvest sugarcane. Activist and former corrections officer Reginald Moore had warned local and state officials that remains were buried in and around Sugarland, but officials weren't listening. But as fate would have it, in early 2018, construction at the site of the Fort Bend ISD New James Reese Career and Technical Center unearthed a forgotten piece of Sugarland's past, an historic cemetery where 95 individuals were buried. Sugarland, the investigative 8-episode podcast series from the Texas Newsroom, explore this well-kept secret. Recently, In Black America spoke with co-host and executive producer Brittany Martin. Ms. Martin, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're born and raised.
I was born and raised in Houston. I did leave for a little while for school and work, but I didn't go too far. Went to Austin and then San Antonio and then right back to Houston. So I got out, but I came back.
And what sparked that initial interest in journalism?
In journalism, I think just being overly curious and having nowhere else to go. I just really wanted to ask people questions that you're probably not supposed to ask and just, you know, tell other people's stories all the time. I think I'm a gossip, so that's probably why.
And some of the news organizations you've worked for thus far?
Yes, I started working here in Austin at the Dallas Morning News Austin Bureau covering the Capitol. And then I went to the San Antonio Express News in San Antonio covering healthcare. And then I went independent and I've written for the Washington Post, Texas Monthly, the Daily Beast, all kinds of people.
I understand. Now, we're here today talking about